Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors, maintaining an unwavering focus on your future so you can focus on what's most important to you, your business, in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Reston, Virginia, and Greater Boston. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. Larry Rifkin along with John Krofcik. And John, you know that in a jocular sense, many years ago, I said to you, maybe those of us who are over the age of 55 shouldn't be allowed to vote, and we should extend the franchise to those 16 and over, because they've got to deal with many of the decisions that we will be making. And when you do look at this election year, you've got a gentleman who's 74 running against somebody who's 77. So you really begin to wonder about their long-term vision, if you will.
Yeah, but then you got the problem of children's brains don't really mature until they're about 26.
I do understand that, and we did that in a recent podcast. But the question is, when do our adult brains begin to fade and diminish?
Now this is an interesting question.
Now one's rising while the other's falling.
I think 16 is too young, though.
Sixteen may be too young. Having said that,
my 16-year-old self, wouldn't they give a crap about anything going on?
Well, I would have trusted your 16-year-old self more than your whatever age you are. But seriously, when you think about it, one of the long-term issues that our children and grandchildren, and you have a grandchild, I hope to have one, that they are going to be facing is the environment and the climate and what we've left to them. Some think it's almost irreparable what we've already done unless we change course very quickly. There are others who are certainly trying to make the consciousness of these young people much greater than it is today, because we've got, for example, our current president, who basically has gotten us out of the Paris Accords, saying we don't have to deal with this, and yet we see hurricanes, fires, tornadoes. We see extreme weather going on everywhere.
Well, the good news is the car companies and a lot of American companies are still going that route. And I see more and more, you know, green energy. I see more and more, you know, people coming up with batteries. We got Tesla with the new battery I saw online. And so there is stuff happening.
Oh, I agree with you.
There's a lot of stuff happening.
That it's almost the business community, which is so rare, except for the fossil fuel industry, aside from renaming themselves an energy industry. We're not fossil fuel anymore, but we are. And they're funding all kinds of organizations on the side to keep pushing against the whole notion. But with that, we do have to acknowledge that a lot of American businesses are so far ahead of where the government is today, saying, no, we don't want to relax the CAFE standards. We have retrofitted all that we're doing, and it's working for us.
Right. So, I mean, that is the good news going now. You know, we still got a long way to go, but at least we got to start there. And you know, the other thing is we're going to run out of fossil fuel. You know, I don't know when. They keep pushing it out because they keep finding these new reserves, but it's going to happen. And
yeah, we've got to move on. Harriet Sugarman is the executive director, John, of Climate Mama. And she's a professor of global climate change policy and world sustainability. And she's a wonderful woman who's written a book called How to Talk to Your Kids About Climate Change, and a book that helps them turn angst into action. So I'm wondering, John, do you ever, because you have three children, and they are certainly adult, do you ever talk about these issues with them?
Well, I mean, constantly. You know, two of my kids have houses, so we're constantly, I'm giving them ways of saving energy. which saves them money and also helps the world. I mean, let's face it, you know, any little thing we can do can help, so.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a wonderful opportunity, particularly at this moment in time when everybody is gathered together, to think about sustainability. I was just seeing in urban areas where people are starting their own victory gardens, if you will, beginning to think about sustainability and caring much more about having those things that they need much closer to them in their neighborhoods. So perhaps this COVID-19, if there are any silver linings, is that we are spending more time thinking about our future. And our future has to involve getting serious about this issue. And that's what Harriet really wants to convince us of. And she does such a great job of it in her book that I wanted to talk with her today, and we do that in just a moment here on America Trends.
Climate Mama.
Yeah.
Welcome back to America Trends. With me on the line is Harriet Sugarman, and she's written the book, How to Talk to Your Kids About Climate Change. And Harriet, you love to talk to adults and children about the issue of climate change, but we've been so distracted of late with so many other issues that seem more immediate that it is really hard at times to get climate change into the conversation, I would imagine.
It is and it isn't, because in fact we are living a climate emergency. It's something we need to get comfortable with in a very comfortable way, because it's going to be with us for the rest of our lives. So in some ways, that's why it seems like it's far off. But, and we need to deal with these other things first. But they're all connected. And as we figure out how we're moving through our current crises, we need to do it with a lens to the climate crisis as well. And so that, both with kids and adults, needs to be a mantra of sorts that we remember, that it is not something that's happening seven generations off or happening 100 years from now. It's happening now and happening quickly, and there are things we can do about it.
I had David Wallace Wells on the podcast about a year ago, and of course his book was compelling because he tried to bring it to very human terms to understand what the impact is on all of us. And he said sometimes we talk about it as something far away and well into the future. So it's only happening at the ice caps in the Arctic and such. But we really need to bring it and drive it home. And I think when somebody says in their community that we've had 2 500-year floods in the last 10 years, that's the type of thing that does get people's attention. But how dramatic do these changes need to be, as opposed to gradual or in our face, to get the public's attention?
Right. And as you said, because it's happening over the course of our lifetime, and depending where we live, because it absolutely does, we can hide it better in certain parts of our country than, you know, we see happening in other parts of the world. But even in our own country, in certain neighborhoods, in certain places, they're being hit right now with it. But it's not the same as what happened to us with COVID-19, where immediately everything got shut down. This global pandemic grabbed us. In some ways, though, certainly in the history of the planet, right, nothing like this has ever happened. Scientists are telling us the speed and the scope of the changes we are seeing in the history of the planet are in a blink of an eye, yet because they're happening over a person's lifetime, seems long. But that, you know, for us as a species, for all of the other species on our planet, as you know, I'm sure in your conversation with David Wallace Wells, he takes what if the worst case scenario comes true? What if we are, you know, if we don't do anything? And he, I think, starts his book by saying it's worse, much worse than we can imagine. Yeah. And
absolutely.
I mentioned that.
Well, just play this out for me, Harriet. I mean, recently, of course, we've been struggling with the COVID-19 crisis. And then all of a sudden, the racial strife in America came to the fore. And how quickly the American public, and both issues are dramatic and important, but all of a sudden, the notion of social distancing, which was on the top of everyone's mind, somehow receded into the background, and I see throngs of people not socially distancing. Now, I know it's important to be out in the streets, but look how quickly Americans move and walk away from another imminent crisis on their doorstep.
Yeah, and it feels like, you know, in those first few months with COVID-19 that it was a lifetime. And so I think people you know, felt like, well, we protected ourselves, we are moving out, or whatever it was, but it didn't go away and it's still lurking. And in this similar way with the climate crisis, all of these things, though, I think they point to the fact that we need policy implementation. We need guidance. You're right. We're not going to get everybody to move, bring everybody along with us. And for that, we need industry. We need our political leaders. We need those that recognize the seriousness of the crisis to put in place policies that are going to be implemented, not just talk about it, right, but move us to action. Because you're right, the 300 million of us, you know, that's a hard thing for us to all each individually figure out as we're dealing with our lives. But that's where leadership comes in. That's where recognition of the urgency of the crisis demands that things happen. And it can happen not just at the national level, but we need towns and communities. And we're seeing that with COVID-19, with racial unrest, where communities are coming together. We need that to happen with the climate crisis. And
now, I've heard this for at least the last 10 years, that we don't have a moment to waste, that the planet is really crying out at this moment in time for the attention that we haven't given it. And yet, all I have seen in the last few years is backsliding. And so we're farther behind than we were when I was having this discussion on radio 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And let me read this. The Trump administration is reversing nearly 100 environmental rules. Here's the full list from the New York Times. And these rules deal with everything you can imagine, from power plants to cars and trucks, a whole range of opportunities for those who really don't care that much about the natural environment to go out and try to take from it all that they need to generate more fossil fuel activity. So we're not where we even were a few years ago. So now what do we do?
Yeah, wow. You talk and say it exactly as it is, Larry. And those are things we need to keep in the forefront. And it shows us, I think, and it should show us that who we vote for and who leads us can actually change very quickly things. But you're right, those problems, you know, we're putting Band-Aids on things where that we need to triage in a much more dramatic way. And as more years pass, the more difficult it is for us to actually rein in what's happening. We did see, you know, in some ways, I think it woke people up in those first few months with COVID, when really activity stopped. And we saw people looking at the Himalayas from Indian cities. We saw a waterways cleanup. We saw the ability of the planet to heal herself, but yet not from the climate perspective, right? Because we still see CO2 emissions going up, because we've already put in place many of those things, both from our oceans, they're reaching a saturation point, from our forests that are, you know, instead of being carbon sinks, are putting it off. So, but there is that window that, okay, you know, we don't know everything. We don't know for sure, because we even saw in this past year that there are ways that our planet can regenerate, can come back. So I think scientists on that part of it aren't clear. They're definitely clear. We've created this problem. It's worse, et cetera. But I think
you talk about it as the Anthropocene, the age of man, and that is a term that has been bandied about, that we now are in control of this, or we're the ones to let it get out of control. And you also tell us that byproducts we're seeing, the wild weather events, sea level rise, food and water shortages. I had another guest on recently who said, if you didn't like the wars in the Middle East, wait till you see the ones that are going to be created because of these shortages and the displacement of human beings. You've got these vector-borne diseases flying across the globe. And at the same time that we're all understanding this, we are looking at an administration and an American public, I will say, because I just don't think the American public is tuned in. I really don't, and I don't quite understand it. I mean, they might give you, Harriet, at meetings lip service, but what are they really doing? How much are they conveying this to their legislators when we've done so many things in this period to revoke directives for federal agencies to minimize impacts on water and wildlife? I mean, the basics, clean water and clean air, things that we took for granted we had already dealt with are again at the fore.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the reality that we're facing. But I think, Larry, to, you know, just play that devil's advocate there, there are more and more people that are waking up to the fact that we're not doing enough. There are youth voices that are being heard and paid attention to in ways that weren't before. I have a quote in my book that talks, that quotes the head of OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum States, talking about the impact on their leadership of their kids and what they're saying to them. So you're right. We're going in the wrong direction. The administration federally is taking us in the wrong direction. But yet we know, too, and we know that the Paris Agreement, it's not enough, but it was a start, that we are going to meet and exceed the U.S. commitments of the Paris Agreement because of what cities, towns, and states are doing. So I think at the same time as we point out those realities that we're not doing enough, that the administration in charge is doing things that are undoing what we have done, we also need to recognize the positives, the movements that are happening on the ground, the changes that are happening from an energy perspective with battery storage capabilities, with our move at the state level to redo how we get our energy, to redoing agriculture. There's so many positives that are happening too. Mm-hmm. Is it enough? Hard to say, but we'd point out a lot of the negatives, which we should because we don't want to hide those, but there actually is this groundswell I am seeing, not just in climate circles, but from business, from industry, from, you know, communities on the ground to that are recognizing this, that are changing.
I'm happy to hear that. What about the business community? Recently, I know the car manufacturers pushed back on changing those CAFE standards, saying that's the way our technology is now being built. We can make more efficient cars. We don't want to go backward. So who are these players today who are enlightened about the climate crisis? You mentioned towns, cities, states. Where do you put the business community in this mix?
Yeah, I think the business community, you know, in many regards, right? You're right. You mentioned the auto industry. There are many manufacturers that are going all electric, right? They are, you know, they have their 5-year, their 7-year, where they are not going to be producing gas cars or trucks anymore, or the majority of them are moving forward in that direction. We see, I think, a real call by industry to, whether it's in consumer packaged goods and clothing, et cetera, to show they're sustainable. And you mentioned before, you know, lip service or greenwashing. We have to guard against that, but we as individuals, as consumers, as purchasers, seeking out those companies, those in the business community that recognize that, we see on Wall Street, we see a big movement to divest from fossil fuels, that those are stranded assets. That is a real, that's taken off. It's, you know, there's been more than $1 trillion divested pension funds in cities. So cities and states have a big power in moving those things forward. Those are all happening on the ground. And those industries are waking up. Even, you know, we ideally we would have the energy companies become renewable energy companies, you know, who knows, but we certainly need to stop subsidizing them.
Well, many of them are talking that way, Harriet. They're suggesting that they're not in the fossil fuel business, they're in the energy business, and that can include solar, it can include wind, it can include hydro, I mean, a whole range of things.
We'll be back with more of this America Trends podcast in 30 seconds. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes us different. Our partners are true business advisors, listening, analyzing, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can, anticipating your future goals and drafting plans to make sure you get there. Because at Bloom Shapiro, achieving your success and satisfaction is how we measure ours. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
Harriet Sugarman is with us. How to talk to your kids about climate change, turning angst into action. Harriet, I understand what you're saying, but when I do look at it, the agency that has been set up to protect the American people, the Environmental Protection Agency, is now being run by a coal industry former lobbyist. And that makes people wonder whether the the hen house is being occupied by the fox. So tell me, why shouldn't that, or should that, disturb me greatly?
Well, it should disturb you greatly, Larry. It should disturb all of us. But sadly, the role and the power of the EPA, not only under this administration, but leading into it, has been diminished. And its enforcement mechanisms, its ability to address the climate crisis in particular, has it doesn't have the strength that, whether it even did at one point, I'm not sure, but it certainly doesn't have the moral authority, and I think that's obvious and clear to everyone. So that's being picked up, I think, in many cases by our states, who are doing more than the minimum that the EPA sets. It's being picked up by our towns. When and where that's all right for them to be able to do that, they are doing that in many, many respects. And I think that we're seeing as well in studies put out by Yale Climate Communications, George Mason, that look at the viewpoints of Americans that, and you can, they have some really cool tools actually where you can put it in your own zip code or your own, you know, you can move in and out on that, that the majority of people now actually, and this is across political spectrum, understand that climate change is real and that it's serious and it's happening to them. Certainly politics gets in the way in terms of partisanship. That's something we have to move away from, and, you know, because it's happening, as we've talked about, to all of us really quickly. And so if you're not going to be involved in the solutions, you need to kind of get out of the way. But those are interesting studies to look at as well, too, so people recognize truth.
More than 60 environmental rules and regulations have been reversed officially, revoked, or otherwise rolled back under the Trump administration. There are an additional 34 rolled back still in progress. And we're talking about air pollution, drilling, extraction, infrastructure, animal protection, toxic substances, a whole range of things. Is there anything that you think, if there is a new administration in the future, well, there will be other administrations, that they must get to very quickly to undo any of the damage such that it's not permanent?
Right. I think that many of those rulings now are being challenged, and that's, you know, unfortunately, many environmental and climate organizations are being tying themselves up in court to challenge many of these rulings. So that's happening. So it's unclear that all of them are going to, you know, that are being put forward are going to be rolled back. But many of them are, clearly, as you said. And I do think that the next administration that comes in that will hopefully understand the urgency of the climate crisis, we need to protect our Clean Air and Clean Water Act that are being challenged now and change some of those things around right away. You know, everyone will talks about we need to rejoin the Paris Agreement. That's, we do, we, you know, that from a moral authority perspective, but yes, we need to look directly at many of these and move forward and move quickly beyond. I think immediately we need to take away subsidies from those fossil fuel industries, let them function and move forward at a market-based approach. They don't need to have tax subsidies. They don't need to, you know, again, be given these gifts from our federal government that clearly now, with all of the expenses of COVID, as we move forward, this next administration needs to build with climate in mind. You know, we need to put people to work. We need to shore up, build resiliency, adapt to what we know is down the line. And that all needs to be done from a climate perspective. I think there's so much opportunity there for the federal
government. Well, there's a renewed conversation about infrastructure. And I think we are going to have to get on to that at some point in this culture. We're way behind. We're living off that, which in many ways our grandparents helped to build. So how much of that has to be energy efficient and climate oriented in order for it to be effective long term? And is the environmental community involved in the conversation about infrastructure?
Yes, the environmental community, the climate community is involved. And I know there's some negative connotations from people when we talk about a Green New Deal, but taking the name out of it, build, having a 10-year plan, a longer-term plan that builds stronger bridges, that builds, helps on shorelines to protect our communities, that looks road structure that, with the heaves and what happens with heat and cold. I live in the Northeast, that we need to think about how we're building our infrastructure to withstand the climate changes, the extreme weather that's coming. And that takes understanding that and then doing it and making it happen. And that also will put people to work. We need a moratorium, from my perspective, on new fossil fuel infrastructure. We don't need any more. We are doing with energy efficiency, shutting down not just coal plants, but we don't need that centralized system of energy distribution. The idea of distributed energy is one that is taking off, and all of those things are exciting, and there is potential for us, for our kids, to be involved in what that building forward looks like, and I think that has to happen right away.
Natural gas was seen as a transitional fuel, that it would be a little bit cleaner than some of the other oil-related and petroleum-related products, and yet with fracking, there's this big question mark. Have we gone too far, and do you think natural gas is still that transitory fuel that we need for the foreseeable future, or is that something that you would lump in with all the other fossil fuels?
Yes, from my perspective and from the scientists and the researchers and the information that I have seen, we made a mistake there. It is a fossil fuel. It's methane. It contributes to climate change in a much more direct, short-term, putting us closer and closer to that climate cliff. And it is not a bridge. It's a plank to a cliff. And we need to recognize that. I work with a lot of parent communities that are on the front lines of fracking and natural gas. To build out natural gas, you need to put compressor stations every 50, 60 miles. So these are coming through urban, suburban, rural communities. Pipelines always leak. It's just a matter of time. So gas is not the bridge to a renewable future. It is not the way to go.
And you point out in your book that methane, of course, has to be considered alongside carbon dioxide in terms of that which we are putting out into the air. And a lot of times people don't recognize that. I want to ask you, as it relates to children, and I hate to lump adults and children together, but I think at times the messaging that you, perhaps, as the director of Climate Mama, are sending out to our young people might be the types of messages that also get through to those of us who are not children any longer. I mean, how much do you have to help to illustrate and simplify what we're looking at here? Because, as you say, it does happen over time, and it's not as direct as having a virus in your midst. It's not as direct as seeing acts of violence that have to be thought about by your community in different ways and try to remedy immediately so that it doesn't happen again. So how do you do that? And what about the messaging you're doing? Is it good for all of us?
Absolutely. It's good for all of us. And our motto and a message that I use in the book, but from Climate Mama, are things that I think our parents taught us, those of us that are parents, maybe teach our kids. And it's very simple that we start with, we tell the truth, actions speak louder than words, and we can't be afraid. And I think in all of those things that you just mentioned, and directly with climate, we need to educate ourselves about what the truth is with the climate crisis and the reality of the urgency of it, so we can speak more clearly to our kids and have that understanding to ourselves. Because, sometimes I think we think these things are too big, it doesn't impact us, or I have no say or control, and we put our heads in the sand. It's going to happen anyways. We need to address it. We need to then deal with the sadness that brings on as a parent, as an individual, as any person, as a child. When we understand the reality of where we're at, it's terribly sad. But then we need to move beyond that to action. There are things we can do. We can't just give up, because that should be unacceptable to any of us, because it's unclear that we know that it's going to be difficult in the future. How difficult it is up to us. We really are born into, those of us, whatever age we are, that are alive right now, we're alive at a time where we can make changes for who precedes us, who comes after us, in a way that actually will impact their lives and ours directly too. Because as we talked about in the beginning, it's not way out there, it's happening to us now. So I think it's not just for children. I think that in fact, if we can make sense of it for us, then certainly we can then explain it to somebody else. But we need to come to terms with understanding it ourselves first.
And what is the time frame that you see? Because again, everybody tells us that if we don't do certain things by 2030, 2035, what do you see out there? I mean, how quickly does the messaging and the support and the federal response, along with the international response, have to gear up? In what time frame, or we really are in peril?
Right. I think, you know, what we hear, slightly different messaging from, you know, whether it's coming from the activist voice, the scientist voice, the policy voice, but the science that should be guiding us on all of this is telling us that we have limited time. It doesn't say that the world ends in 2030. What scientists are telling us is that we're going to pass tipping points. We're already pushing out on our planetary boundaries. We're pushing out where we pass some of those boundaries. And can we, you know, pull back? Well, we need to do a lot of hard work every year moving forward. Should have we started 30 years ago? Sure, but we can't go back there. We just need to go forward. So it has to start now. And if it starts, you know, the message that I share in the book as well, too, is it's such a big problem that there's no linear path. There's no, like, if you do this, this is the way forward. There's room for all of us, wherever we're coming in from. And then those that can do big, we need to demand that they jump in with both feet. And, you know, that's implementing policy, that's our corporate leaders, that's business, that's financing. All of those things we've already talked about really need to jump on it. So it's a short, you know, it's happening in our lifetime. You know, how for almost everybody alive on the planet today, but it doesn't mean the world ends. It just gets more difficult. There'll be more storms. As you talked about, that 500-year storm, you know, is happening every 10 years. Well, maybe they'll happen every year. You know, it just means there's a 1 in 500 chance. Maybe that chance is now a 1 in 100 chance that it's going to happen. Sea level rise is happening. We need to be thinking strategically about communities that are on the shore. How do we move, you know, back from the shore? Food security, water security, all those things. There's so many points of entry. For whatever your passion is, to move it forward, we need to do that. And that is also a message in my book for ourselves and for our kids. We need to do it with a lens on climate, and we need to do it quickly, as you said.
Harriet, during this recent bout that we've had with COVID-19, one of the things that might have been looked upon as a silver lining is that people noticed that there was less pollution from cars, but there was a seizing up of economic activity. And I don't think that Green New Deal really deals with economic development and activity and tries to seize the entire economy in order to produce the results that we need environmentally. And some question whether, in fact, we can have the same amount of economic activity or continue the notion of growth while we're making this transition to a more climate-friendly environment. How do you look upon that?
Yeah, well, I think first in addressing the Green New Deal side of it, you know, maybe that's been maybe co-opted to be some thing that it's not. It was really left very open, just that we build forward with sustainability and climate in mind and bring people back to work and build responsibly again and to deal with what's coming. But in terms of the COVID-19 crisis, and we did see air pollution clean up, but that's those small particles in the air that allows us to, you know, cities in India to see the Himalayas in a different way, to clean up air pollution in LA or wherever, but the climate pollution itself has continued to rise. The carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has continued to rise, and that is what's being measured in Mauna Loa and many places where our NOAA and different organizations that measure that level of carbon dioxide tell us it's continuing because of our oceans being saturated. They're not able to absorb the carbon dioxide in the same way that they were. Our natural world is less of a carbon sink. It's not drawing down in the same way that it was. So even though we've stopped that economic activity, you know, not tailpipe emissions are not the biggest source of CO2 emissions. That comes from buildings. And so there's a lot of, and we're still using buildings, even though we might, it might be in our home instead of our office. And so those temporary changes that allowed our air to clean up, I think that's positive because people will remember that and they'll want that, right? We want to be breathing cleaner air, but we're going to need to do more in different ways on reducing our greenhouse gas emissions that we're putting up into the atmosphere to address our climate crisis.
The book is called How to Talk to Your Kids About Climate Change, Turning Angst into Action. Harriet Sugarman has been our guest. In closing, Harriet, if a parent is listening and wants to use your book as a resource, your organization, and other resources, what would you suggest they do? Where should they go? What are the easiest messages to get across?
Absolutely. Well, I would suggest they have a look at our website. It's climatemama.com, and you'll find links to the book, et cetera, there. But the book is available wherever books are sold, online and in your local bookstore. It's an audio ebook and out as a paperback, so you can find that there as well. In the back of the book, we list resources, scientific resources, ways to talk to your kids, organizations, youth organizations. There's a lot of great, you know, top 10, and there's so many organizations and resources out there, but there's a list in the back of the book. There's a way to generate conversations also as a guide in the book. So I think there's a lot of great information that they'll be able to find in the book, and you can find that, again, through the website or anywhere that books are sold.
Harriet, thank you so much for being with us today. We really appreciate it, and a very important topic indeed. Thanks for coming by on America Trends.
Thanks for having me, Larry, and thank you for asking those hard questions and looking for answers. Thank you for having me.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes Bloom different.